The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, June 7th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, journalist, author Corey Pine on his new book, Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Also on today's program, Trump plans a confrontational approach with world leaders at an economic summit, even as he invokes the War of 1820 in a testy exchange with Justin Trudeau over trade tariffs. U.S. border agents have made more than 50,000 arrests in May for the third month in a row, says the Department of Homeland Security, as the ramped-up war on refugees, migrants, and non-white Americans accelerates. The ACLU is suing over family separations, and a federal judge struck a blow against the Trump administration on Wednesday, holding the policy as the case moves forward. And talks fail to resolve the GOP immigration showdown in the House as the far right holds strong for a all-white America. Mick Mulvaney fires 25 members of a consumer watchdog's advisory board as he continues his aggressive efforts to undermine the modest reforms for consumers of the Obama era. And Democrats vow to bring back stupid and harmful spending rules if they win back the House, because there's no doubt that in an age of accelerated inequality, mass disruption, authoritarian leadership, what most normal people are really hungering for is arcane budgetary rules that block the delivery of resources to them. Good stuff, Democrats. And Trump seeks to reorganize the federal government, combining safety net programs under Health and Human Services while also recommending big changes in other agencies, all amounting to slashes, cuts, and burns across the board. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Four of us are here today. The four-day-a-work-week man is not here, which is, of course, why I'm in the main chair. And we're all trying to make sure, particularly Matt and Jamie, to not give Brendan a cold, because Brendan has remained unscathed and he has some big plans that we cannot disrupt. Sean Hannity is one of the most anxious people on the planet. Now, I am not like a big Sean Hannity watcher. He's, of course, nothing compared to the greatest broadcaster of our generation, Alex Jones. He doesn't bring much to the table entertainment-wise. So I don't know if he's always been this sort of tense as a broadcaster. Excuse me. I don't know. I know that he's never seemed... I've never really gotten his appeal. I mean, the joke with Sean Hannity is it's sort of like a, I think it was like a middle school gym teacher in Long Island won an award for a Fox show, has been the line on him for a long time. But as we go deeper into the Trump era, and as the pressure mounts around people like Michael Cohen, and Sean Hannity's relationships to these people get slowly revealed to be deeper and deeper and deeper, to the point where some people, including potentially some criminal prosecutor type people, might be starting to ask themselves, why doesn't anybody call Sean Hannity? Maybe we should. Sean seems to be getting super anxious, and so I wanted to share this clip from last night with Sean Hannity talking about how those who are being subpoenaed by Mueller, maybe what they should be thinking about. Of course, this involves Hillary Clinton, but there's some other stuff going on here as well.
So this is interesting. They are demanding that witnesses turn in their phones so Team Mueller and, of course, his pit bull, Andrew Weissman, and Jeannie Ray, who worked for Clinton, get to review all of their electronic communications. He wants the phones turned over, even texts that are on what are called encrypted apps like WhatsApp or Signal or one of these things. Now, maybe Mueller's witnesses. I don't know. If I advised them to follow Hillary Clinton's lead, delete all your emails, and then acid wash the emails and hard drives on the phones, then take your phones and bash them with a hammer into little itsy-bitsy pieces, use bleach bit, remove the SIM cards, and then take the pieces and hand it over to Robert Mueller and say, Hillary Rodham Clinton, this is equal justice under the law.
On the next Sean Hannity segment, how to fake your own death but keep your real estate holdings and hide your extensive business dealings with Michael Cohen. That's what Hillary Clinton did or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, just to keep us up to speed, we don't know exactly yet what his connection is to Michael Cohen.
We know that Michael Cohen did some legal work for him. We have no idea what the specifics of it are.
But from the way he's acting, he definitely did something.
How to drive out of Times Square without getting caught. Because, you know, Hillary's a bitch or whatever on Sean Hannity. Warning, contents under pressure. Sean Hannity show now.
Remember in January, I think it was, there was Julian Assange or a fake Hannity DM'd with Julian Assange, and Assange told him to get a WhatsApp or a encrypted messaging services.
Well, I thought, wait, I thought it was a fake Assange and a real Hannity.
Oh, no, I think, I'll look that up.
Oh, I thought Hannity thought he was dealing, I did like the way, like, Hannity was just like.
It was a fake Hannity.
Oh, it was a fake Hannity.
It was Sean Hannity with two underscores.
Like, yeah, it's like, you know, Signal or WhatsApp, I don't know. Certainly nothing I would know about. Certainly not apps I'm using. Robert Mueller's a pit bull. He's even using encrypted phone services to uncover crimes, which is super intense.
Has he not heard of the Streisand effect?
So now liberals will talk about the Streisand effect.
Like, seriously, the more you talk about something, the more people think about you in relation to it.
Probably not his audience, but yeah. That is true. I cannot wait to see. This is the fun part of what all these people do for us, is we get to see slowly what, I mean, it's going to just be some sort of low-level scumbaggery. What is this? Oh, Olivia Nunzi, Newsy, whatever. Sam Nungberg tells me he's handed over his old BlackBerry phones to Robert Mueller. Of course, Sam Nungberg has a BlackBerry. Wait, what's the... Okay.
He was really pissed off that they got his BlackBerries. I didn't know this was such a long thread.
Nunberg was pissed off that, like, you can't take my BlackBerries. I mean, that's ridiculous. I already talked to you on the phone and in person, and now you're taking my BlackBerry? Okay. All right, guys. We obviously, Majority Report made possible by you. Become a member today. Majority.fm/become a member, I believe. We'll be right back with Corey Pine. Silicon Valley is not your friend, Musk cultists.
The pressures of your life and it tough. Now stay down, mama, time pick it up. Now bother with the down, full style, strictly up, full vibes. Now pick it up when the bills, them, the rent and the mortgage due. Yeah. When me chalice, when your best friends are gone and it's only you. Yeah. Light up a spliff, turn up the music. Skanking swing, everybody.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Corey Pine. He is the author of Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Corey, thanks for being here.
Always happy to be on the Majority Report.
Always great to have you on whatever show I'm hosting, Corey. This is a great book. It's very timely. I feel like you picked a moment when pretty much, unless you're sort of just totally deluded, you're skeptical about Silicon Valley. But how did this process start? You actually moved there and tried to create a tech entrepreneur lifestyle for yourself. How did that, what was the inspiration behind that? And how
well,
did that work out?
Well, you know, I talk about in the introduction, I was something of a true believer before I started this book. I mean, I was a newspaper journalist for years and just, you know, getting laid off, enduring pay cuts, all of that shit. And, you know, I thought that the tech industry looked pretty good by comparison. This is, I'm talking back, you know, to post 2008, 2010. I think it was 2010. I decided to leave my newspaper job and launch a startup of my own. It was called War is Business. And the idea was that it was a defense contracting watchdog site. And the buzzword at that time was crowdsourcing. So it was going to be crowdsourced. And of course I wound up being the only person that really contributed anything to it. But I learned, some stuff before I burned out, like many solo entrepreneurs do, about how, Google exerts its monopoly influence in the market and about the sort of, cult-like, motivational propaganda that exists to egg on people who want to start tech companies, you know, and make it big in tech. And I was kind of, I really actually did buy into a lot of that stuff. I was reading Hacker News every day, teaching myself how to code and doing all of, basically doing what the standard advice was back in that period. So anyway, I burned out after about a year of that. And, sometime later took a job at a proper startup that somebody else had founded in London that had, you know, investors in beanbag chairs and, you know,
so that's serious stuff. The beanbags got broke out. Okay. So there's some real ideation going on here.
And an espresso.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a real startup. Anyway, it got acquired, as many startups are. They called it a successful exit, you know, for the founders. And I stuck around for the aftermath and realized that when a company gets sold, it's always bad for the company, and it's always portrayed as a good thing for everyone involved. But it was the opposite. I mean, you know, it was a news startup, and the new owners, it was Bill Gates, actually, one of his companies, immediately wanted to do like a 50% staff cut. And I ended up resigning because I thought that would put some of our people in danger, because we had people in like Syria, all kinds of places where they were at risk. And we needed to be fully staffed so that there were no periods when, if somebody got in trouble on a story, there would be nobody around to help or make a call for them or whatever needed to happen. Anyway, so I went through a couple of really disillusioning experiences about the tech industry and was then kind of unemployed for a while. Not sure if I'd what I would be doing next, if I'd be going back to journalism or if that would even be possible, after quitting an editor-in-chief job after 6 months. So I wound up, you know, kind of hanging out in my pajamas and getting bitter for a while, and then started writing about just sort of taking it out on the tech industry, started freelancing again, writing some articles that were kind of cathartic about how you know, this idea of entrepreneurial journalism was BS,
right?
And how there was a real sort of creepy, sort of fascist undercurrent in the tech scene, and that led to the book deal. So the original concept for the book, the original title was "How to Make $30 Billion the Silicon Valley Way."
Yeah,
and which
let's do it as a follow-up book. Still a good title.
Well, no, you know, the title kind of served its purpose because I decided that if I were really going to write about the tech industry, I needed to go to the heart of it. I couldn't just, you know, report from my couch, as comfortable as that might be. So I went and I told everybody I met in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley that I was working on a book about how to get rich in tech, but also that I was trying to secure funding for a startup of my own. And that's sort of the narrative premise of the book.
And so you found a couple of different things here. One was that the sort of, even the idea, and if we take as a given that, of course, from the beginning, that we talked about this on my show, but we could expand on it here and still use the same kind of framework. In a way, you're doing a history, in my view, of a Silicon Valley is this sort of like hyper-condensed history of capital, basically, because you sort of have a public good that's generated as a commons. It's government-funded research. It's created through academic communities, amateur communities, also private sector activity, but stuff that's totally interdependent and inseparable from government investment community networks. Then it's privatized. That's like the primitive accumulation where you turn a commons into a private asset and then people just eat off of it. And, you know, even these ideas, like, it's very funny. I mean, we'll get to Elon Musk in a bit, but one of the most sort of hysterical responses you get from his cultists that really prove that he's just a certified genius is that in the 1990s, the idea occurred to him, as it probably would occur to like literally any like 14-year-old, that at some point people are going to buy stuff over this new thing called the internet. In fact, it's probably mostly what they'll use the internet for. And therefore, you should create a platform to process people's credit card information or even skip credit cards altogether if possible, right? For like online banking activities. Now, to get the money, the investment, the wherewithal to actually do that, of course, that takes something. But like the basic concept is totally obvious. But there was a time when, if you had the right connections, theoretically, you could go to Silicon Valley maybe and have that kind of story. Okay, I'm the guy who's doing pet food online or whatever. By the time you get to the Valley, even those sort of like pockets of openness are gone. So what's actually happening in the startup community? But still, there's a rush of young people going there with fantasies of being the next Jobs, you know, Bezos or Musk. So what's the reality that they're actually finding when they get there?
Overcrowded, slum-like Airbnbs and jobs that allow very little personal autonomy and seem to make everyone miserable. I mean, the burnout that I experienced as sort of a one-man band running a website is not limited to that. I mean, it also applies to the kind of software engineer, marketing jobs, whatever that right. People are flocking to Silicon Valley to take. And, you know, most of my reporting was done in 2015, the on the ground stuff, although there's more up to date information in the book than that. That still, looking back, looks more like the salad days than now. When a lot of the easy money has dried up. So it's, you know, to quote Star Wars meme, you know, it's a trap. Don't go. In fact, people are leaving in droves. They're coming to cities like Portland, where I live now, and telecommuting if their employers will allow it, which many increasingly do, because the housing costs have gotten so out of control. It's really the tech bubble has ruined San Francisco, and some of the book is about that sort of a lament for the city. And people have really picked up on that aspect of it as well.
Definitely. We'll get to that more. Where was the easy money going? And if those were the salad days, what's going on now? From particularly, because, yeah, like, the reality is that most of these jobs, and of course, relatively speaking, these are relatively privileged jobs to other part of the economy by and large. But yes, people are overworked. I don't know. What are they, like, content ninjas or, you know, coding wizards or all this other nonsense? They work in marketing and coding for big conglomerates where they have to work all the time. But there's still an idea that you can go there and strike it rich and get, you know, some type of breakthrough. So what's actually, like, going from the entrepreneurial end, from that perspective, like, where is the money going? How does one get that money? And what does it look like even, yeah, relative to today versus 2015?
Well, step one, get admitted to Stanford as an undergrad.
Right.
That's really the main thing. I assumed that my connections, I mean, I went to a state school and an Ivy League for graduate school, and I assumed that my connections would be enough to sort of open doors there, and typically they weren't. The culture around Stanford, which is really sort of the heart and the brain of Silicon Valley, is really one that pushes its young engineering and business graduates out as soon as possible, sometimes with the encouragement of administrators and faculty to drop this whole thing about dropping out and making it big. I mean, that's actually encouraged in some of these departments,
right?
Because they all know that it's the money that matters at the end of the day, not the education,
right,
that they're supposedly getting. So the network is number one. They're going, as far as the ideas, the kinds of companies that get funded, it changes over time. Right now, AI is the big thing. Right. When I was there, it was the Internet of Things. There have been a couple of previous iterations. I mean, I mentioned crowdsourcing, which sounds like ancient history, right? But there's something new every 6 months, and the trick is just to take whatever you've got and figure out how to slap the right buzzword on it to ride the wave at the moment. So right now, as far as my information has it, the thing is still AI. So you see a lot of companies, and I heard this from a former AI engineer at Google, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of the startups, the AI startups that are getting funded now, are basically run on Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is a service where you can hire people to do very simple tasks like filling out CAPTCHAs,
right,
online for pennies, or even in some cases, I think, fractions of pennies. So the AI revolution is probably some, like, wage slave in a Bangladeshi, like, click factory.
Of course.
So that's an example of the kind of stuff that goes on. So I was pitching startups that seemed a little bit...
Yeah, let's get to that. What startups were you pitching, and what was the ultimate sort of culmination of that? This is the other thread of the book.
There's only one in the book that I write about, but in fact, I pitched a number of different startups. I'll tell you about one that didn't make the cut. It was called Mole Mountain, which is a terrible name, but I wanted a mascot because there's like Hipmunk and all these companies with mascots at the time.
So, yeah, mascots are big, you're right.
So I described it as a secure platform to exchange information between people who know something about a company and people who want to know something about a company and are willing to pay for it. The shorter version of that is that it was a platform for corporate espionage.
Right. And, right. I like this. This is good. Yes.
And as was the case with many of my ideas, as soon as I would go pitch this, I would pull up the tech press a week later and find that a company had already gotten funding or just secured funding to do what I was pitching in a somewhat tongue-in-cheek or satirical intent. So that was one. I pitched this corporate espionage one, and then this, there was actually a lot of audience interest at this pitch competition I went to. Like, this Russian woman came up and winked at me and gave me her card.
Nice.
And, like, her boyfriend was standing there, or I don't know who the guy was. There was just a lot of curious stuff.
His name was Yuri.
You cannot go broke pitching corporate espionage startups in Silicon Valley. I think that one is still the game is still on for
them. Yeah, definitely.
The other one I pitched that is in the book was called Laborize Strikes as a Service. And the idea was you would hire us to organize a union at your competitor's company.
So Uber kneecaps Lyft before they can even get their car fleet on the ground by organizing Lyft drivers into a union.
That was the idea. And I was actually inspired by Uber and Lyft going at each other in all these underhanded ways. And I thought the common thread with all these apps that are getting funding, the gig economy apps, is they're all like complicated ways to basically reduce the cost of labor.
Right.
So I thought, what about an app that increases the cost of labor? And right.
Cause
that solves a real problem that people have because people don't have enough money.
Why would you want to solve an actual problem, Corey? That seems really... Wait, was the theory, though, that you would... That it's on such a fast cycle that nobody would follow the logic of what you were doing? Like, it would be like, oh, well, sure. Like, not like in 2 years, oh, my God, all car ride services could be unionized, but more like, oh... That could work great in like a week-to-week cycle. And since everything is so short-term that they wouldn't even like do any horizon planning with it, was that kind of what
exactly.
you were thinking?
It was a bet on the short-term greed of the investor class, which is, you can't overestimate it.
That's a solid bet.
And I don't want to give away what happened with a startup. You kind of have to read the book.
Yeah, you have to read the book.
But, I will say that, I did not leave in the part of the pitch about how eventually companies would keep hiring us to organize their competitors until there was only one company that wasn't unionized, and then you could boycott it.
did you have... But that actually raises another really funny point, that when you talk about... And obviously, I mean, there might be legal problems potentially with either of these two startup concepts you talked about, but you make the other point that with a lot of the main, major companies, I mean, Uber being like a prime example, it's basically just, if I understood you correctly, it's like, what? Oh, is that you? Are you typing, Corey?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No problem. That if there's a legal barrier to what you're doing, then you basically just build in like a scenario where, first of all, you can absorb the fines, and like changing the law is just part of your long-term business plan. So just launch it while it's illegal out of the gate.
Yeah, that's the common thread too with a lot of the unicorn startups, right? Like you break as many laws as you can to get as much money as fast as you can, and then have politicians or, a compliant court system legalize your past misconduct. I mean, we've seen that with Uber, for instance, Airbnb. There's some pushback now, like a little late for some people, but that is a tried and true way to make money online. Is to break the law. I mean, there are even copies of my own book that friends ordered on Amazon that they were not supposed to. These are like gray market copies, right? Like international editions that aren't supposed to be sold in the U.S. Other sort of dodgy things, which I find amusing in the irony of it, but also infuriating because I'm probably not getting a royalty on that. So.
Yeah, that's infuriating. what you also go into like the sort of the lower end of this stuff in the sense that like, okay, there's the dream, go to Silicon Valley, create you know, a multi-million dollar valuation company, and then in fact just sell it to one of the big four or five, which is the other kind of funny thing about the business model. I mean, Peter Thiel literally advocates for that in his book that he put out a couple of years ago, which is really ironic.
He's pro-monopoly.
Pro-monopoly for a self... I mean, I guess it's more coherent than most libertarians usually are, but those guys like to sort of generally pretend that that's what... that pure fantasy market competition would lead to being opposed to monopolies. He's literally saying is the goal of your startup should be to find your acquisition angle for Facebook or Amazon, and then you can kind of get, you know, sort of... get fed in the chain, as it were. So there's the high end of it. The low
he's,
end of
he's
it.
Not,
yeah,
I,
no,
I don't want to.
No, please.
Just a little tangent on, yeah. Or asterisk on Thiel.
Oh, in yeah. Really, book, Corey? You really want to talk about me? Really? Sure. Go ahead, he also, Corey.
He also says, I don't think he's really a libertarian. He also says that startups are best run like dictatorships. And, you know, like many on the right, would like the government to run more like a business. So, you know.
There, the conclusion.
Yeah, that
yeah. Well, let me put it to you this way. You're not only will you be bankrupt and homeless, but also your friends. So, way to follow the logic, Corey. Intrepid reporting. See you in court. Corey, is like a tech journalist is like, yeah, that's really not funny.
Don't even joke about that. Jesus Christ.
I joke about this often. I think it's possible that if Peter Thiel were to do something like this, maybe the guy who always does the impression might be atop the list.
Yeah, nice one.
So that being said, you also went into the lower end of the, you know, the sort of the market, the sort of multi-level marketing schemes, you know, the real... profound desperation area of the web of people who were, you know, basically getting scammed in low-level internet marketing schemes. What's that about as well?
Okay, this is the thing. This is the aspect of the book that has these more privileged class of techies more mad than anything else that I wrote in my experience so far in terms of hearing reactions. Because... if you've been online, you know how much scam content is on there. I mean, it's right. Like a majority of probably the display ads online, right. The stuff on YouTube, the ad filler on YouTube very often for some multi-level marketing scam. You go down in the comments, it's bots posting links to scams. Of course, everybody's familiar with spam email. I mean, the reason that they're mad about it
right.
is they want to think that they're different than these 2-bit con artists
right.
that are trying to like convince grandma to sign up for, you know, monthly prescription drug program, you know, black market from Canada or Cuba or wherever they're coming from, or that they're different than the people who have guaranteed money-making systems, you know, like some...
the old GMS, guaranteed money-making systems, yep.
Or they're pitching, like, unregulated dietary supplements.
Right.
But they're not any different in spirit or in content. You know, in fact, one of the most prestigious people in the tech industry, Ray Kurzweil, who's a futurist, as well as director of engineering at Google, has a side business selling anti-aging supplements.
Right.
and many of them have been criticized by people in the skeptic or anti-quack community as probably doing more harm than good. So it's not like there's no harm to these scams. But another aspect of it is these scams comprise so much of the internet and especially the ad business. Remember, at the end of the day, Google is an advertising right. business. Same with
right.
Facebook.
Right.
That, you know, I do make the assertion that based on, you know, studies and people that have looked at it, but I make the point in the book that the revenues of these big tech companies are probably significantly inflated by the lower level fraud that happens online, organized or not. And they're very sensitive about that for a good reason, because many of the big companies are now getting more scrutiny. Post Cambridge Analytica and post Theranos, people are starting to look at the fundamentals of the internet giants. And I think the more that that happens, the more closely or clearly we'll see the connection between the biggest companies like Facebook and the dodgiest, most amateurish, you know, con advertisement
right
at the bottom of a news article on patriottruth.com.
Right, right. That's the funnel right there. Do you, you talked about how, and it make, it actually makes a lot of sense why the sort of upper end people, the wine track people would be super offended that you drew the connections between them and the beer track people, right? Like, we're going to use that kind of basic marketing differentiation here to describe that. And I think it's partially because, I mean, Silicon Valley has had an incredible ride in terms of public perception. I mean, there was a very, you know, there was a stretch of years there where there was like not only no critical commentary about Silicon Valley, but really, you know, the same way some kind of weird fanboy from Elon Musk online, who I do want to get to in a second, could have this sort of almost religious hope. That was just like the press, you know, and a sort of...
Yeah, and Silicon Valley was effectively embedded in the Obama White House.
Right.
I mean, he right. came out with all this Code for America stuff. Right. I mean, that was coming from Google, former Google employees that were handpicked to work in his administration. And one of the most frequent visitors to the Obama White House was Eric Schmidt.
Right. So do you think, so then now what's happening, and certainly we can, yes, there's no doubt that Obama was just, I mean, that's going to, there's going to be, to use a tech term, there's going to be a long tail to the failings of the Obama administration with regards to Silicon Valley. That being said, now we're in it's an interesting place, and I think that this parallels a lot of other parts of our politics, where it's like Silicon Valley is going to get away with it and be held and not held accountable and distort our markets and corrupt the political process and, you know, destroy privacy and be complicit in a scam economy because they can, because they have the money and the resources and the power, and that's what runs politics, right? Less so because as many people buy the mythology now. So at least the sort of cultural end of the equation is starting to loosen a little bit. And I think even like the reception to your book is sort of in line with that, right? I think if you put this book out even in 2013 or 14, there would be a lot more just kind of basic, like, you're a Luddite, you know, just sort of base hysterical reactions, not an actual, you know, analysis of this, what the reality of this economy is.
As we
So as we move into that phase, I mean, first of all, how big a breakthrough is that? And secondly, is that the harbinger? Like, does that mean that the next phase is the, you know, movement? I mean, we talked on TMBS on Tuesday about the scooter protests that just happened in San Francisco, where they're like blocking the Google buses. This is like hilarious, but also very effective disruption of the city, which zeroes home the destruction of the Bay Area by this industry. What do you think the kind of through line of that shift from the waking up of the cultural sort of hypnosis to the actual politics of it?
Well, I think it's happening much as you described, because people are seeing consequences in their day-to-day lives. I mean, odds are good that if you live in an urban area, you've interacted with the gig economy, and you probably have some sense after a few years of exposure to this that it's not a healthy thing
right.
for workers, right? Or even for customers. The political aspect, I would not have guessed a couple of years ago that we would see the New York Times editorial board, for instance, saying maybe it's time to break up Facebook. That is a more radical position when it comes to the posture toward this industry than I would have assumed a mainstream publication would take. Notably, you didn't see that in the Washington Post.
I wonder why that is. It's just amazing when people are like, you know, you gotta admit that Jeff Bezos is funding a lot of really good reporting. It's like, first of all, I don't have to admit anything. And secondly, like, this, if ever there was a walk and chew gum at the same time moment, would be like, yes, very glad that there's some tough reporting on, you know, the emoluments clause in the Washington Post. And Jeff Bezos is literally going to turn us into some type of, like, hybrid Amazon-China hellscape of, like, ultimate authoritarian capitalism if we don't do something about it.
I wanted to tell an anecdote that I think answers your question. And it's something I heard on book tour. So after I saw you in New York, I went on to D.C. to do a reading and then came back to the West Coast. But in D.C., I was talking to people that worked on the Hill, one of whom pointed out that the Cambridge Analytica scandal really made congressional Democrats very, very mad, because there was this attitude, like with the Obama years, like, oh, everybody knew Obama loved Silicon Valley, and right. That's part of the reason they wouldn't criticize it. But also, there were, you know, the Valley companies were donating so much money to the Democrats because to get their priorities through. But with the Cambridge Analytica scandal and the outcome of the 2016 elections, a lot of Democrats are now going, wait a minute. Right. You know, we don't care that much if, you know, you're degrading labor standards and avoiding all kinds of regulations and you know, destroying the fabric of urban America. But listen, you mess with the election and you're messing with where we eat. So right. Now they're not friends anymore, and they might not even be frenemies anymore. Because there's a lot of Democrats in D.C. who want to get to the bottom of what happened in 2016, and they see, you know, Facebook in particular as playing a major negative role in that election. What questions of, you know, Russian influence aside, I mean, you'd have to concede that the sort of political communications that people receive on that platform are not the most sophisticated.
I would concede that, but isn't that actually, the really dangerous things though about the responses that companies like Facebook are engaging in now, as an example, is that if you don't have any type of editorial process, then it's like, of course, it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, some insane Alex Jones bit, where he, you know, Mars has a cocaine production facility for the Clintons or something, is the same thing as, I don't know, you and I doing a segment about the DEA picking sides in the Mexican cartel wars, as an example, which is real. It's a true story. There's nothing conspiratorial about it. And it reveals a lot about U.S. foreign policy. So a lot of the moves that those, you know, that Facebook particularly has undertaken is basically just reamplifying, you know, such as they are, the incumbents online, right? And that is going to, yes, it might undermine some bad conspiracy content, but it's also going to undermine, you know, good investigative journalism, which obviously they don't have a problem with. But even that sort of fake news meme and that obsession, I think, you know, their way they're going to address it, it's going to be a disaster.
You can say that, but it's also true that Martian Coke is the purest, best Coke.
right. That's
well,
fine.
Look, I...
Hey, look, that's a great point. At least you're honest about it.
I think there's another level of the responsibility that these companies have, that they've abrogated, and we're dealing with it, the deleterious effects every day now. You know, back in the day when I worked at newspapers, I can't imagine any newspaper that I worked for ever running a letter to the editor or accepting an ad from, say, a Holocaust denier, right? The at best, to the most generous way to put it, at the at best libertarian ideology in Silicon Valley that has a very unsophisticated understanding of free speech and corporate responsibility says, we'll take their money. You know, we'll take the Nazis' money. It's just free speech. It's all the same. What's the big deal? And they've created, I mean, what's Alex Jones without YouTube? I mean, there's a reason he was panicking when he was going to get demonetized from there.
Right.
What would Roger Stone's access to, you know, even the Fox News empire be if he didn't have this network of, you know, conspiracy freaks online reaching audiences through the major platforms?
Right.
And they won't hire, they won't fix this problem because it's contrary to their profit model,
right,
which involves not hiring human beings.
Well, and I think also you just, like, it's funny, like even something like the issue, and I've talked about this before, like with Twitter and, you know, harassment and, you know, neo-Nazi voices and stuff like that, there's been a lot of focus on the sort of cultural aspect of it, the cultural problems, which is a legitimate thing to talk about, obviously, in terms of, you know, who runs these companies and diversity and voices inside these companies. It's definitely an important issue. But the structural issue is that those are literally the reasons that, like, a company like Twitter has survived, are precisely those accounts. So, of course, it's going to take a very long time until there's potentially a brand problem that is so toxic that it threatens their ability to be acquired, as an example. Then maybe we start kicking some of these accounts off. But the fundamental
thing is,
maybe.
I'm sorry.
Well, they did a few. They did that sort of semi-purge several months ago, but not any of the, like, you know, soft ones, as it were, because that's business. It's money. These people bring in the algorithms that they need.
Well, and Trump. I mean, Twitter doesn't care.
Well, yeah, Trump is the biggest soft alt-right Trump Twitter account. Like, of course.
And Twitter will never do the right thing when it comes to the Nazi hordes or Trump for the reasons that you said. But I don't think that there will even be a branding issue that fixes this, because many of these companies have, because they got lucky and had first mover advantage and grew to quasi-monopoly status, I can't imagine. Everybody hates Facebook now, right? Like, nobody wants to be on Facebook, but they've basically become the phone book. So how do you even stay off it, particularly if you're someone who has to survive in a white collar workforce, let alone media? You can't not be on there. In fact, employers deem it suspicious if you don't have a social media profile. That's the kind of society we have now. It's not even the dystopian future, it's the present. So I think we need actually political solutions when it comes to dealing with these companies. There's not going to be a market correction. If there's a market correction in the sense that, you know, the tech stocks take a dive and a lot of the second rate companies get wiped out, I mean, that's not going to fix the problem, because it's going to leave the big players that were able to hoard cash in that much of a stronger position. Any sort of brand damage, Facebook in particular has shown that it's very adept at spinning narratives, to the extent that the public even gets one narrative. They've been very good at deflecting attention from their own business model and practices after Cambridge Analytica, and blaming rogue actors, although some good reporting is showing that Facebook itself has a lot more to answer for.
Right.
So we need politicians who will commit to strengthening, you know, the regulatory apparatus, to investigating these companies, looking at all the different angles, antitrust, espionage, you know, fraudulent business practices, consumer protection, privacy protection, surveillance capitalism, all the way down the line. And we need politicians who will do that. And for that to happen, we need people to realize that it's a political problem, not a consumer problem.
And it's also
switching to some different social media platform. You know, you hear open source advocates promote this approach quite often. It's not enough. You know, it's like when the crypto people talk about, well, you just need to pick stronger passwords and we need to educate people so they can protect their information.
Right.
That's not going to do it. The architecture of the internet is not set up in a way that it's going to be secure for people like this. Like, we need government action.
So that was the question. We definitely need government action and we need actual power. But the question that I had for you, which is in this sort of like interesting tension, because you hear people, including on, you know, very worthwhile projects, and some of these projects will become like, you know, necessities. Like, there's a project in New York City to sort of preserve, you know, net neutrality in the city. That's something that people who, you know, are going to need to figure out at a very practical level, right? So that's all legitimate. But I think that there is a tension between, you're right, on one hand, I like the activism around it because it's going to take social and political movements and action to sort of put the political pressure to bear you're talking about. But at the same time, you know, this notion that people need to be tech savvy in order to deal with tech is part of the problem.
Oh, for sure. I mean, first of all, forget what that means for older people and others who might have difficulty learning these, you know, arcane languages and design interfaces that make sense to young white engineers and not a lot of other people.
Right.
I frankly think that people should have a right not to be bothered by tech,
right,
you know, and not to have to use a computer if they don't want to. The only reason these devices have proliferated so much in our lives and become such a constant presence is because it's profitable for these companies. And I think if we were to construct society in a truly democratic way and not just what the richest people and you know, the most powerful companies decided our cities and our day-to-day lives should look like and feel like, then we might say, well, maybe we don't need you know, gadgets everywhere. We don't need screens everywhere to broadcast advertising to us. We could reclaim some of the sort of pleasures of having undistracted time.
Right.
And this is where I can rightly be accused of being a Luddite, although my house is filled with computers and I still like to tinker with them and stuff. I think you need time away from these things. And the addictive aspect of some of these technologies has, you know, I gave a laundry list of stuff that Congress should be looking at. That's one of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's very troubling to me that basically no one knows more about the addictive properties and the manipulative potential of social media than the social media companies. And whatever they know about persuasion, about manipulating people's emotions and moods, and about not only that, their individual preferences, that should be public information. And it's at the level where you need like a church committee style congressional inquiry to get to the bottom of it. I mean, this situation has gotten really overwhelming and disturbing in a short amount of time, and I don't think anything short of a big government inquiry could sort it out.
Do you think, let's just do Elon Musk for a second, because this shocks me, actually. I'll try to give the least polemical description of him that I can give. Because we've done some videos criticizing him, and granted, it's YouTube, so obviously YouTube does have this, you know, much more sort of right-leaning tilt. But I do think in the popular culture, he's the kind of last vestige of this fantasy about a billionaire who will save you and is this sort of like enlightened wizard that wants to like get you to Mars or whatever. I don't know what people think. But let me give you the least polemical description. You know, ultra affluent guy from South Africa who's white. So that already should be, I would say historically, you should ask a few questions if you're a bit historically inclined. not besmirching him or his family. I'm just saying, like, okay, contextually, that's interesting. I think there's a story of him selling emeralds or something that he pocketed from his dad when he was a kid, or, you know, it's just, okay, it's eccentric. Then, you know, makes a massive killing along with Peter Thiel with PayPal, which, as I said before, like, of course, I mean, somebody needed to do this in the internet, and they had the wherewithal and the connections and the financing and the tech to do it, and, you know, good for them. But, like, this isn't something, like, I mean, it's like, yes, you need to pay for things on a new, essentially, you know, commercial service. This is not like genius level thinking to know that that would be necessary. And now he apparently accepts the science of climate change and is done some, you know, is wants us to give people luxury electric cars and has this Hyperloop idea, which he used to say, I have to say, he used to say it was because, you know, public transportation is icky because somebody could be a serial killer on it. You wouldn't know they were a serial killer or something like that. He's also, like all of these people, has Mars interest. And more recently has been taken to Twitter to sort of seems to be essentially, I think, if you were to threaten journalists with a rating system because he doesn't like bad coverage of himself. And then actually ironically pushed a very almost like, you know, kind of 1990s dorm room progressive idea, which is that, like, oh, I get bad coverage because of the oil companies that advertise, man. And, you know, I guess I'm still being a little polemical. I don't think he's, like, the worst person in the world. But here's a guy who's a plutocrat, a government contractor, very right-leaning in his politics, and maybe has some potentially interesting ideas for sort of, like, luxury green consumption. None of which have been proven to be viable in mass market production or have shifted climate or any of these big goals he's talked about by his own metrics at all yet. And we also know about the labor violations, so on and so forth. And if you criticize this guy, it always is what fascinates me. It's not even like a, hey, man, I think you're being a little unfair or you're dismissing innovation, which I'm actually not. But the, like, you have attacked Jesus sort of or Muhammad level of reaction to these devotees. Or, of course, you know, Bret Stephens in the New York Times writing a great, like, he attacked Elon Musk and then it turned into a defense of the internal combustion engine, which wasn't a great look. But, you know, Sam Harris, who, of course, is a big Bret Stephens fan because of their anti-Palestinian politics, you know, tells Bret Stephens to get his shit together. Because he attacked the great one. What is that about? Like, what's the emotional economy going on there with this bizarre hero worship of this guy?
I mean, Musk is the power fantasy of the geek. Last time I was on TMBS, you know, he played that clip of these fanboys who were like made these videos about, didn't they call him Daddy at one point?
I think they literally called him Daddy.
It was so over the top that you would have thought it was satire. And that was part of the problem with writing it, the difficulty anyway, with writing it, trying to write a satirical work of nonfiction about Silicon Valley's reality keeps going beyond. Musk's fans are really at another level. I mean, they're almost like Scientologists.
Right.
In the sort of way that they've rehearsed answers for every argument and the pile on. I guess I don't know that they're building dossiers on critics like Scientology, but the reaction is very similar. And I think there's a theme which connects, you know, Musk to Trump and American capitalism in general, and that and also, you know, the sort of American tolerance and encouragement of cults in general. It's part of our sort of founding ethic, right? To tolerate crazy religious ideas of all sorts. And I think that, you know, in the same way that Trump has this cult of personality and Musk has this cult of personality, and they've risen to these positions of power, it shows that to head to be the head or figurehead of a corporation, you know, this something of a legal vestige of feudal society. That's how, right, I think of corporations, right?
Right.
You've got to have a sort of
the sovereigns,
a propaganda. Yeah, yeah, you've, yeah, got to have the sovereign has to have a propaganda apparatus that reflects glory back to him. And so, you know,
and you can get a little bit of, because the thing that always just amazes me is it's like, I guess this is the extent to which I actually do buy some of this logic. It's like, guys, like, you're not part of that. Like, I don't know. Maybe people who are obsessively online and seem to have nothing better to do than defend these people, maybe they're actually secretly like fucking captains of industry. But by their, you know, what it appears is that they're sad guys with a lot of time on their hands. And it's like, you're not part of that winning. Like, are you aware of that? Like, you're not of this. And there's no reflected glory on you for being like a stalker for people that you'll never meet. It's just that's what gets me about it. It's not even
materially speaking, that's true, but clearly, right, they must be getting something out of it emotionally.
Right. Right.
And, you know, that's somewhat mysterious to me, although, you know, if, I guess in the same way that a parent can experience, you know, some feeling of validation through pushing their child into, you know, piano lessons or whatever that they couldn't do for themselves, I think that Musk's fanboys have this vicarious sort of genuine feeling of accomplishment or,
you know,
satisfaction.
Like, so you're like, man, if I was, I'd be blowing out people's like joints from overwork myself, and I just feel like I busted a cost of living increase request by myself. It feels amazing. Hey, Mom, could you heat up those Hot Pockets? It was a great week. The Musk Industries. Yeah, it's super pathetic and disturbing. Well,
it's a story as old as American capitalism, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's
doesn't what, it go back to the Horatio Alger myths of yore? Like,
no,
there are
Alicia,
no poor people, just temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Sort of.
Because, for sure.
Yeah, but I think at least with Horatio, I mean, at least it's like Horatio Alger didn't say you should be sitting there. Like, it's like, at least if you're buying into that, you shouldn't be, like, you should be out attempting to live out that fantasy. Like, there's something, like, even more mediated by it.
Well, many of, right, them are. Who,
yeah,
who do you think is running the 2-bit right, internet get-rich-quick schemes?
Right.
I mean,
right.
There are
right,
people. There are people at the end of these
right,
websites, you know, somewhere.
Right.
And this is the kind of, this is what I say about how I used to be a true believer before I started the book. I mean, I was reading all of this stuff, mostly to learn how to code and do all that development work. But you couldn't absorb that without getting some of the entrepreneurial propaganda on the side. Right.
Right.
And there's different flavors of it. And Musk gets the people that sort of see themselves as environmental do-gooders or whatever.
Right.
Right. So right, there's any.
Right. Right. Okay. We only have we're actually way over. We have like a minute left, but Jamie has a quick question for you. Go ahead.
Hey, Corey. So, as we've talked about, like, so much of tech money and so much of the profits that are being made are built around minimizing the cost of labor, whether that's the people driving cars for your illegal cab company or the people literally writing the code. And I think there's this romanticized idea in the tech industry of like, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And also the idea that we just talked about, that everyone could eventually become an entrepreneur, start their own company and become an exploiter themselves and make tons of money. But are tech, as these things develop, are tech workers starting to see themselves as workers and organize in some collective way? Like, what is your experience of that?
I think that they are. I think that that was just beginning in its earliest stages when I was doing my reporting. But one example of this you see is Google employees basically getting together, doing a petition, and forcing the company to abandon a big defense contract, working on basically AI and Skynet. And there was an article in Jacobin. They did a Q&A with an anonymous Google employee who talked about how they did it. And that's worth a read because it kind of recaps this story. And yeah, it just came out yesterday. If you check my feed or Boss Carson Carr's Twitter feed, you'll find it easily. I recommend that. And I know you've got to, and also I should say on that point, I've been approached at readings by, you know, people who are sort of inside the companies and wondering what they can do. And I usually tell them there are others like you, you know, you might have to keep your head down at the office, but, go to a DSA group or something and you'll find a lot of tech workers who are getting, developing a class consciousness.
Corey, we're about to run, but tonight you have a reading.
It's actually tomorrow.
It's tomorrow. Okay. Let everybody know about that.
I know you have listeners in Portland. Tomorrow night, that's Friday, June 8th at Powell's City of Books on Burnside, 7:30 p.m.
Okay, so everybody.
Come out if you can.
Yeah, definitely check it out. Corey's a great reader. I caught him in Brooklyn. The book is Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey to the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Corey Pine, thanks a million as always. I appreciate it.
Great to be on. Nice talking to you.
Bye. Okay, everybody, we're going to go to the fun half where we're going to continue to have fun. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member or click support on the Majority Report homepage. JustCoffee.coop, you know, all that stuff. All that stuff that keeps Sam in his 4-day work week. Hi, I have a proposition for you. Have you ever wanted to work a 4-day work week and talk about politics and why Republicans are bad? I have a guaranteed money-making system for podcasts. That would actually be a funny character. Sam, internet marketing wizard. No, but seriously, do that today. Subscribe to Majority Report on iTunes. Leave it a review or a rating. Where are we at on YouTube, Matt? Those like in terms of subscribers on YouTube.
Oh, we're going to hit 300K in the next 2 weeks, probably.
So if you haven't done it yet, now is the time. Matt, Literary Hangover. Tell everybody about it.
Literary Hangover is my new podcast. It's a book sort of history podcast. We go into the sort of historical context that sort of created the books and are sort of represented by them. Patreon.com/literary hangover.
Jamie, what's going on with Antifada?
Well, we just recorded our second premium episode, and this one is really exciting for us because it's interactive. So we took a lot of questions by email from our listeners and answered pretty much all of them. So that should be out in a couple days. Check it out.
Sweet. And of course, TMBS, new Woke Bros coming out, the new offering exclusively for TMBS and Count the Dings patrons. Tuesday, Assad Haider, Alona Minkowski. We had another great post game. This Sunday, Mark Blythe, and a new Right Wing Mandela animation. So we're on the move. Patreon.com/TMBS. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.
Total.
Pussy.
Total.